país, pero con la misma dignidad que
we
tienen
are
los europeos y los norteamericanos.
Small country, but with the same dignity as the Europeans and the U.S. have.
Former Honduran President Manuel Zelaya. He was ousted in a U.S.-backed coup in 2009. To see the interview in Spanish, visit democracynow.org/es. To see all our coverage of Honduras, go to democracynow.org. Special thanks to Maria Taracena. And happy Democracy Now! 15th anniversary to our transcript editor, Neil Shabata. Thank you, Neil, for your incredible work and wisdom. Joining Mike Burke, Mike DeFilippo, Isis Phillips, and John Randolph in the 15ers Club. We kneel before you, Neil.
What a time, what a warm and wondrous time. So sweet a shining moment in the sun. Oh, what a time, was there ever such a time? Then suddenly it's done, the moment passes. Does the time go? Must we let it end? Where does the time go? Gone too soon, my friend. And where go the echoes of our
time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end?
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Attention licensed practical nurses. Are you looking for a convenient way to earn your RN degree? Do you need the flexibility of a program who recognizes you for your previous hard work as an LPN? Here's great news. Henry Ford College has exactly what you're looking for with their Advancement LPN to RN Bridge program. You can advance your career and become a licensed registered nurse. Want more info? Give us a call at our School of Health and Human Services at 313-845-9877. That's 313-845-9877.
And welcome. Welcome, Dearborn, to another edition of New WHFR Journal. Today's show is going to be about your city, the city of Dearborn. Dearborn is the eighth largest city in Michigan. It is one of the premier cities, a unique combination of residential, commercial, industrial, a pioneer city because of the work of Henry Ford and other pioneers that came from the city, home to several actors, politicians, and to the good people of Dearborn. I have been honored to have an interview with the curators over at the Dearborn Historical Museum. And without much further ado, let's get to that interview. Gentlemen with me, Jack and Paul. Jack, it's a pleasure to meet you, sir.
My pleasure, and thank you for coming and seeing us.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. You have an interesting history, my friend.
Well, I'm a lifelong resident of Dearborn, born in 1941. I've lived here all my life. I've been involved with the museum in one way, shape, or form or another since 1953.
Wow.
And 41 years on the commission, and a little over 7 years now as acting chief curator.
That sounds like a job that entails a lot of responsibilities.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. It's been interesting. When I first arrived here, there wasn't much going on here, and now we have all kinds of activities going on. And I also have Paul, who's come on board, and it's kind of great to have somebody with actual museum experience under their belt, because I'm an automotive guy.
Well, you could have got a job at the Automotive Museum, I suppose. But
that probably wouldn't have interested me.
Well, how did you come across getting into the museum there? Is it a love of history?
I love history. If I wouldn't have ran out of money after I got out of the Army, I probably would have ended up being a history teacher. But I ended up as an engineer and manufacturing and material control at Detroit Diesel Corporation instead.
Well, that's very good. That's very good. So, and Paul, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm from Troy, Michigan.
Very cool.
Fortunately, not a Dearborn local. But I have a background in museums, so a couple years back I got my master's in museum studies out in Seattle at the University of Washington. And same as Jack, just have a passion for history. My inclination has been all over the place, archaeology, but also the objects themselves and how do you teach people, how do you present information, so I just love being around such a vibrant community that cares about history, and being here at the Historical Museum has really introduced me to so many people in the community who care about history and so many awesome opportunities to share what's going on in Dearborn.
Well, that's very cool because, you know, to me, I mean, it seems like most every community has a historical museum or something, but Dearborn's is particularly seems to be one of the most active community-accentuated museums.
Well, I think we definitely are today. Paul's going to go over and give you an idea of some of the events we have going on right now, but we've already completed this year our teddy bear picnic. We had our arts, Animals and Waking, our spring fair. It's been very active, and I'm glad to have Paul on board now because, again, we need to get involved a lot more with the actual presentation of the history of the city. And I think that's what he's going to come in very handy for us. I brought events back at the Teddy Bear Picnic. I've installed a system for storing our artifacts so we can find them. When I walked in here, the place was bulging at the seams.
Yeah.
But you didn't know where anything was. And so we've been slowly over the last 7 years cataloging, going through the collection, cutting it down to where it should be. And everything that...
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is...
...on our system, where we can go and find it if somebody asks for it.
Well, very good.
And that's something we never had. So those are my contributions.
Well, that's an important one because you want to be able to find, you know, if you got something that Henry Ford used, you know, you want to be able to find it, you know.
I agree. And like I say, from a public standpoint, our awareness of the public that we're here has grown significantly since I've been here.
Okay.
Has a long way to go.
Well, sure.
That's Paul's job.
Yep. Yeah. That's something that we're working on pretty constantly. As Jack mentioned, we do a whole lot of community events. Man, during the summer, it feels like they're every weekend.
Yeah.
So we had, just a week or two ago was the Teddy Bear Picnic, a big, big event here. Jack's a big fan of it. And then coming up, of course, just next week, which is scary to think about, we have Over the Top at the Wagner, which is Dearborn's 90th birthday. Following that, the 25th, 26th, and 27th of July is going to be the Museum Guild Yard Sale, which is just an enormous yard sale here at the museum. And the museum itself contributes some of those items for sale. The museum also has a hand in homecoming. That's another big weekend for us. And then coming up in September on the 27th, we have the annual Museum Guild Beer Tasting, which is also this year partnering with a sculpture festival.
Oh, really? So,
yeah, that's part of the Dearborn Heights Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
That's an annual event they had, and we're going to partner with that this year, which is going to be a great thing for both of us. The sculptures are going to be throughout the area that we have the beer tasting in, and the chamber is going to have people around who will take down your bids if you wish to purchase one of the sculptures.
Oh, very nice.
And it's been a very successful event for them in years past. And we're hoping by putting it here, more people will get to see both events.
Well, does the yard sale now, is that a sale of excess inventory from the...
Not so much. Now, the museum, as we've been going through things, we have found a tremendous number of items that people have brought here that no one ever did anything with.
I see.
We call them non-accessioned items. We have no information on them. We don't know where they came from, who they belong to, or anything else. So as we find these, we set them aside, and we'll have a small little corner in the yard sale where we'll be selling off those items, mostly clothing this year,
city's
clothing. And and that all helps, comes back in to help support. That's our biggest deal right now, is getting enough funds every year to support what we're doing.
Well, yeah, you just don't run it on good wishes.
That is true. And the city has been very generous with us. So, our current city council, a lot of kudos for the assistance they've been giving us out of the general.
Well, that's very good. Now, do you take donated items for sale in order to...
That's where the guild comes in. There's, I think, 22 member groups of the Museum Guild of Dearborn.
Oh.
And they all go together every year and collect and bring in things and build it up for the yard sale once a year. So, yes, it's all donated by either individuals or groups that belong to the guild.
Oh, very good. Yeah, and it sounds like you've got quite a collection of things that you're going to be selling, you know.
Well, we'll know when we get it out. It's all in boxes in the basement.
I'm excited to see it. We keep a gift shop here at the museum that is a lot of what Jack was already saying, things that are donated, things that maybe we have in a dusty corner at the museum that we're trying to clear up some space. And personally, I love walking through the gift shop because our volunteers keep it rotating and stocked. And also, we're always selling things. So it's really kind of neat, you know, keeping an eye out. And I know one day I'll walk in there and there'll be a mug or a bowl or something.
Well, I'll emphasize one point. As far as the gift shop is concerned, these donations are not donations. The people bring them in and donate them for the gift shop or for the yard sale. They're not donations to the museum that end up in the gift shop. They're brought in specifically to be sold at the gift shop.
Very cool. Is that how you raise the majority of your funds? Is there fundraisers like this?
Not the majority of it, but we raise a good portion of it. The events, like the beer tasting, bring in some good dollars. We bring in some good dollars at homecoming. But without the support of the city, we could not exist.
Well, that speaks to the generosity of the city, because
yes.
Dearborn has always been interested in its history, and it does have a fascinating history, you know.
Oh, yes. Going back to when the ribbon farms were here during the... and then when the U.S. finally came through and they built the Detroit-Chicago Military Highway.
Yep.
And then after the War of 1812, they decided that they wanted to move the arsenal out of Detroit. And they had a parcel of land further west on the Chicago Military Highway. And that's where they decided to build a new arsenal. And that just happened to be Dearborn.
Yeah, because if I remember something about the treaty, they had to have military stores 10 miles from the borders per a treaty, I think, with the British after the War of 1812.
Well, eventually, that wasn't the reason for it. There was two reasons. Number one is the arsenal fell to the British in the War of 1812.
Okay.
Detroit fell. And secondly, Detroit was growing, and they thought it was not a good idea to have a big powder magazine that belonged to the arsenal in a neighborhood.
Well, you know, that's probably a good idea.
Mm-hmm. And they owned land here in Dearborn.
Yeah, they already owned the land here in Dearborn. It had been set aside for military use, mainly because of the timber, years before that. So they didn't have to acquire any land to do it. It was here. It was right alongside the highway, the military highway. There was, with a little bit of dredging, there was good transportation on the waterway to bring material in here.
Right.
At which they did. And then, of course, in the late 1830s, the Michigan Central Railroad came
through. Yeah, that really spurred Dearborn's growth. You know, I'm always fascinated with this, the French ribbon farms. Why were they called ribbon farms?
Because they were very narrow and very long. And the idea there was the river was the transportation.
Right.
So each farm, they wanted to have a chunk of riverbank and the farm so they would have transportation for their goods.
Oh, very, very interesting.
That was the same in Detroit as well, just because of the irrigation, the transportation along the Detroit River. And that's why today a lot of the street names that run perpendicular to the Detroit River have these French names like Beaubien and St. Antoine.
Of course.
Because those were the original markers of that family's property. I always thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I find it interesting, too, because, you know, a lot of roads are named after the local farmer or the landowner or settlers and stuff, and I always found that pretty fascinating. So the Dearbornville, did the original village of Dearbornville basically grew up around the arsenal? Or
Yes, it did. The arsenal was probably why they ended up being the village. And, of course, then with the other farmers around here, and it also became a hub for them to bring their produce in to buy things. There again, if anybody's interested, we have a book here called...
The Bark Covered House?
Yeah, Bark Covered House by William Nolan. And he talks about all this stuff. He talks about walking from their farm, which was down by, what is today, Van Born, coming north. But walking from their farm and visiting the Pardees, their next-door neighbor, and coming into Dearborn to buy groceries to take back. Also to bring produce in to sell, and then they'd come to Dearborn and then take the Detroit-Chicago Military Highway to Detroit to sell their produce, and that would be, they would leave the evening before in order to get to Detroit in the morning to sell their produce.
Yeah, that's fascinating, and was he like the original settler of South Dearborn there by Van Born?
Oh, no, or? No, I think the Pardees were there before him, and there were several others, but they were quite early. They were the first to actually buy a team of oxen to farm the land with, rather than doing it by hand. They'd loan their oxen out to other farmers.
Well, you kind of had that cooperative agreement with other people, I think.
And then they didn't have a cart. Another farmer in the area actually built a two-wheel cart for the oxen to pull. So they'd borrow the cart, and he'd have the oxen to take produce to Detroit or into Dearborn, or Dearbornville at the time. And it was definitely a lot of cooperation between the various land.
Yeah, I find that very fascinating, and you know, especially you got school, street, all kinds of things named after him, you know.
Well, Nolan and Pardee both.
Yeah, Pardee especially. You know, they mentioned in the book Hardscrabble Road that he put together. Was that any of the streets in Dearborn that had become a street in Dearborn, do you know?
Well, parts of it probably are Monroe.
Okay.
I'm not saying all of it, but parts.
Yeah.
When they first built that road, it was they put logs down. And
okay.
They actually drove over the logs because it was so marshy and wet underneath. The oxen couldn't pull a sledge through it, so they had to make a log road.
Well, they certainly had plenty of timber for that at the time.
Yeah, I think he mentions in the book that they finally got enough land cleared where they could see the sun in the morning.
Yeah, you know, because I'm amazed because you have that large section of a tree over in the museum there that, I mean, it's huge.
Yeah, and I can't tell you now how old that was when it came down. I used to have a sign on it, but somebody stole the sign.
Oh, jeez.
And I'm not about to try and count it again.
Yeah, that's, it's several hundred years old, I'd say.
Maybe if I get bored one day.
Well, maybe I'll come in and count it. I got nothing.
Well, the junior curators, the junior historians, the youth group the city used to have, did count that at one time, and there was a sign on it. And I don't know if we have a record of that in the archives or not, but I know that somebody tore the sign off.
That's funny.
But it's the whole story. arsenal stood here. Well, some of the buildings are still here, but it was an active arsenal until 1875.
Wow.
And here at the museum, we have several different buildings, and many of them are related to the arsenal days. So right now we're in the museum office, and this is where we have our offices, and we store a lot of the historical artifacts that we have in storage, which is actually about 99% of what we have isn't even on display.
Wow.
And then we have the Richard Gardner House, which is 1833, and that's one of the oldest houses here in Dearborn. But the remaining two are from those arsenal days. So we have the Commandant's Quarters, which of course was the home for the Commandants over at the arsenal. And most of that arsenal, the main complex is no longer standing. But we have that, and then we have the McFadden Ross House here at the museum is the former powder magazine for the arsenal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because they didn't want to have the powder magazine right, you know, in the middle of the fort in case something happened and
oh,
there's an
of course,
accident.
Yeah. No,
so that they put it today, you know, maybe two blocks away, and you can still see when you walk through it in the main area that was that powder magazine. There's very, very thick walls, maybe a foot or more thick.
Closer to 3 feet.
Closer to 3 feet. Yep.
That's a lot of brick, you know.
Yep.
It was said that at the time it was built, it was impervious to any weapon around. 3 foot thick walls, vaulted ceiling, and under the tiles roof was also a vaulted brick structure. So supposedly a cannonball of the day wouldn't penetrate the building.
Well, I believe it. That's that's a lot to penetrate. I mean, are there any other buildings that possibly around Dearborn could be remnants of the arsenal?
There are two. If you look across the street from Monroe from the Commandant's Quarters, it's the gun carriage shed, which was purchased by the Masons when it went up for sale from the arsenal. And they put a second floor on it, and that was their hall until they built the one that's down the corner of Monroe and Garrison.
Okay.
The original building still has the original floor in it, and if you go in the crawl space underneath, the original cistern for that building is still there.
Wow.
Now, the whole arsenal complex is interesting as far as the water, how they controlled the water. There was a central cistern in the middle of the square that had all the buildings in it. And then the buildings that had no basement or lower level all had a cistern in them, and that would be filled from the roofs. That was their water supply.
Right.
And then there was an overflow into a central huge cistern in the middle of the complex. And now the buildings with basements, such as the Commandant's Quarters and the office and the Surgeon's Quarters and the barracks, those all drained into that central cistern. And then there was an overflow in that went down to the Rouge River. And, of course, that overflow caused a lot of stories that there were tunnels at the arsenal.
Oh, really?
And my father, who was born in 1900 and played here, before a lot of this stuff was done, they weren't tunnels. They were drains. He says they were big enough for a child to walk in, but not an adult.
Wow.
And he said he and Dave Lappin and the other kids that grew up here at the time used to play in them.
Well, natural. I mean, I remember always playing in tunnels and new basements and things.
So they weren't a tunnel, they were a drain.
Yeah. And that that building is the Italian bakery, right?
Yeah.
And then the other remaining arsenal building is, I think, a doctor's office right
now. It's the back portion of the doctor's office on the northeast corner of Monroe and Garrison.
Oh, okay.
So just a few remaining. Yeah. Unfortunately, I think the barracks burned down.
No, the barracks was torn down when they built Salisbury School.
Okay.
Well, I remember reading the book, and, he had built the bark-covered house and another house, and they built something that they called Nowlin Castle.
Yeah, and that was just torn down, maybe 50 years ago.
Oh, well, that's too bad. I mean, it sounded like it was a pretty nice house that you'd built. But,
before it was day, it definitely was a castle.
A pretty large place, I think.
Yeah, before its day, yeah. Now, we probably wouldn't think that today, but very impressive when it was built.
Wow. Because I find it interesting that they used to go hunting deer a lot down in Taylor and stuff, and they'd take the deer to Detroit and sell them, and that's how they
sell the pelts, yes.
Yeah.
Bring good money. And Well, if it changed the laws, we could probably do that again. We have more deer now in Dearborn than I can remember in my lifetime. When I was a kid, there were no deer.
I don't remember any deer either. I used to always ride my bike along the path along the Rouge River, and I don't remember any deer.
Well, we have them now.
Yeah, I know. I see a few dead ones here and there along the road.
And plenty of green space coming up. Back home in Bloomfield, my mom just saw one. Apparently, it attacked a dog in the neighborhood. Which, what kind of self-respecting dog gets beaten up by a deer?
Yeah, usually they're skittish and would run away from a dog, I would think. But
if you have a dog protecting its fawn, and if a dog would come after the fawn, you'd be surprised the damage a deer could do with those front legs of theirs.
I wouldn't even want to, because I remember seeing one time I was driving down 5 Mile and there's a cop in front of me. All of a sudden he stops. I says, are my headlights out or something? But he got out and there was a dead fawn in front of his car that he picked up and put at the side of the road, that had been run over. It's just, it's nice to see, though. It's nice to see wildlife like that. But then again, maybe there's too many of them. I don't know.
One of the problems I think there probably is or will be, because there's no real natural enemies for them here.
Yeah.
And, of course, you can't hunt in the city, which is reasonable. So their number keeps growing.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting what the future holds. I think the time will come, not only Dearborn, but other municipalities are going to have to put in some kind of control to control their population.
Yeah, I think some communities already have done that.
I think Ann Arbor has, and I think University of Michigan here in Dearborn has too.
Yeah, it's because they get to be too many of them and too many accidents. And
well, not only too many accidents, but they if you get too many of them, you start to get illness in the herd.
Yes,
and they will eat themselves out of their habitat.
Yeah, we don't need that. So this, the Wagner Hotel, now that, where you're having this event next week, it's got quite a history to it too, doesn't it?
Well, the area where it stands did. The first hotel was built there, a wooden structure in, the 1830s.
Okay.
And it housed, Dearborn was always a place where people stopped en route. I can remember some advertisements I saw once that advertised Dearborn for somebody to buy their summer home or something like that.
Really?
As one day's carriage ride from Detroit.
So interesting to think about that now. That
it's 15, 20 minutes, you're there in Detroit, middle of Detroit. And back in those days, it took one day by carriage to get here. But anyway, that's how it was advertised. And so people traveling and stuff, Dearborn was an ideal stopping spot. And not only West Dearborn, but what we call East Dearborn today, and even in between. The Tenek Tavern was... approximately where...
like near Evergreen?
Near Evergreen, but a little east of Evergreen. I'm trying to think. It's where the old North Dearborn Road or Ann Arbor Trail used to come out to Michigan Avenue before Henry Ford built Fair Lane. Then in the east end, there was the Schaefer Hotel, which is now the Schaefer Building and Schaefer Road. And then we have the one here. It used to be Hotel Dearborn before it was the Wagner. And that burnt down in about early 1890s.
Okay.
And then Anthony Wagner purchased that property in 1898, I think, completed the building that's there now.
Yeah, it's this is like a fundraiser you're having for the Historical Society, is it?
For the Historical Museum, yeah.
Is it?
And not only that, but it's to commemorate 90 years of Dearborn.
Yeah, that's hard to think, because, when I was growing up, it's like Dearborn, established city, and, it's hard to think that it's really only 90 years old, and it's not really...
As the current city we know today is 90 years old this year.
So how did Dearborn come to be formed?
Well, it was actually three entities when they decided to come together, and I think one of the reasons they came together, they were worried about Detroit annexing into the area.
Yeah, so, I see they did annex some parts of Dearborn Township.
So the city of Fortson, city of Dearborn, and then the stretch of Dearborn Township in between came together in 1928, and then 1929 became the city of Dearborn with the boundaries as we know it today.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's interesting, because I always was kind of wondering why they didn't, at that time you had the Dearborn Township, that you had the north section and south section. Is there any reason why they didn't include those sections that you know of?
Not that I know of then, and I know attempts were made afterwards to include them that were unsuccessful. until finally they formed themselves into Dearborites.
Yeah, that's an interesting story, the way that happened, too, I thought.
But, no, I have no idea why they didn't include the rest of Dearborn Township when they put Dearborn together in 1928.
Yeah,
just in learning about Dearborn history in this part of Wayne County, not only for Dearborn, but also where we have, you know, Livonia, Canton, this part of Metro Detroit, I suppose. A lot of what I've learned is that there's always been sort of divisions and changing boundaries and changing names, and that's really been something that's defined this area. Maybe not so much recently, since 1929 or so, when Dearborn was formed, but leading up to that, there have been a lot of changes.
Yeah, it's I remember reading about how they formed Dearborn Heights in 1963, and they were able to annex a two-block strip of Inkster, because Inkster was a village, and that's how they connected the two. Otherwise, they would have both ended up as separate entities. And, you know, because people always comment on the shape of the city, I says, well, it's... I thought that's interesting, but so, you know, these three communities, they were afraid of Detroit annexing them. Is that what part of that was?
Well, I think that was part of it, and I think probably one individual had more to do with that part of it than anyone else did.
I wonder who that is.
Yeah, I just can't think of the name right now off the top of my head.
Oh, I know. I know he's got a blue oval somewhere.
Right. No, I think it was very... But that wasn't the only reason. I mean,
of course.
But that was how they... I think that's why they wanted to go with... Of all these different names, they stuck with Dearborn, because Henry Ford had the most... he identified the most with the name Dearborn for where he was from.
Well, not only that, but he did not... As I understand it, one of the proposals was to keep the Fortson name as the name of the town.
Right.
And he was against that. He didn't think it should be named after him and his family.
Well, and of course, you know, Dearborn was named after a famous general, wasn't it, I think?
Well, yeah, General Henry Dearborn, he was made famous in the Revolutionary War.
Okay.
He was, I think, Secretary of War during the War of 1812. And a little interesting side note there, for the first time in the history of the city, he never visited.
He did?
Never here.
Oh.
Now, just a few weeks ago, for the first time in the history of the city, and I hope he'll be back again, a descendant of General Henry Dearborn, who lives in California right now, came to visit us.
Oh, wow.
His last name is Dearborn, a young man, and he said, everybody asked me if I've ever been to Dearborn, Michigan, and so I decided to come.
Wow. That's really good, though. I mean, you know, because...
I hope to invite him back again.
Well, we'd love to have him back. Maybe we can get him down here for the 90th anniversary.
Oh, I don't think that would happen, but I think there's a chance we could get him back again in the future.
Well, that would be good, but yeah, because, you know, and of course, since we're on the subject, you know, Henry Ford, he's probably the biggest larger-than-life figure that's ever come out of Dearborn. Of course, we had Orville Hubbard, too, as another larger-than-life character.
And we had a couple actors.
George Peppard.
Yeah.
Ford, definitely, you know, a world-famous figure today, famous for his business acumen and as an American figure. Man, but a couple decades ago, and even during his lifetime, it was even more. His celebrity during his lifetime was just, I would say, completely outsized, and he was viewed, I would say, as a folk hero for coming up on a farm and becoming just a titan of industry worldwide.
You're talking about Mr. Ford.
Yes.
Well, the interesting thing, too, is that his, now we got a couple generations later, and the family is still interested in Dearborn, interested in Henry. They really pay a lot of attention to what's going on, where he's, which I think is great.
Well, I think so, too. I mean, you can't talk about Dearborn without including Henry Ford, and you can't talk about the rise of American industries and things without Henry Ford. I mean, he's like such a key figure.
Oh, yeah, the $5 day, the 40-hour week, the assembly line.
Oh, yeah.
These were all his doing.
And, you know, and really, to me, it's like the things that he inspired, the assembly line stuff, were things that actually contributed to winning World Wars I and II, mm-hmm. just the way the... didn't he build subchasers or something?
No. Well, the first production at Rouge, because World War One breaking out, went to the government and got a contract to build what he called the Eagle Boats.
Okay.
which were subchasers, yes. And by the time they got into service, the war just at the very end of the war.
Okay.
But some of them survived even, I think there's a couple of months, two or three of them even served in World War II. They were not a very, I guess they were a little bit rocky when you were riding them in rough weather, but...
well, sure.
But they were built in a hurry and... an assembly line process, and he did a lot of them, and they were anything that Ford did.
I've noticed that. You know, he built a car that I think was made of soybean plastic?
No.
Or something similar to that?
Soybean paint.
And it's, and just the phenomenal Willow Run assembly line, I mean, that was just such a creation.
Well, it just showed that between Ford had put together a team of people. You gave them a problem, and they would solve it. The way the bombers came out of that Willow Run plant during World War II, there's no way we couldn't have won that war, because there's no way anybody else could have kept up with us in production.
No, it's, you know.
Ford not only did the bombers, but back at the Rouge, they were building Jeeps. They were building, I believe, three-quarter-ton personnel, amphibian boats.
Okay.
He put together a training center for the Navy there, and they were training mechanics. It was just, he may have been, you know, say World War One, he was hoping for peace and everything else, but when peace didn't happen, I mean, he jumped in and it was 100% for the country.
He was, and I know they had, you know, he had some controversies here and there, but he was 100% American. And,
oh, yeah. And he was just a... And he was a... I don't think he ever considered himself to be some kind of a rich dude that sat around doing nothing. He was willing to get his hands dirty. Personal story. He and my grandfather were the school board.
Oh.
My grandfather was 3 years older than him. And I vaguely remember as a child him coming to the house, and he'd walk from Fair Lane through the river valley and come up into our backyard along the Rouge River in Morley. And I'd get a pat on the head saying, "How are you today, young man?" He'd go in our barn, get my dad's hoe off the hook. Because my grandfather was always out in the garden in the summer.
Oh, of course.
And he'd go out, get in the row next to my grandpa, and they would cultivate up and down the rows in the garden and talk. Whatever they talked about, I don't know. Neither does anybody else, because my grandfather never said a word.
Hmm.
And they weren't socially doing anything together, but he periodically... And I know just, I only know it twice, but I guess several other times it happened. He'd show up at the house.
Well, they went to school together. I mean, people like to stop seeing their old school chums, you know. And, you know, it was just, I just thought it was always odd the way he passed away during the power outage and stuff at Fair Lane. Is that what happened? You know, I mean, is.
Well, the house, well, it was the biggest flood I can remember as a child. Or any time since, of the Rouge. But my next-door neighbor in the house I live in now was owned by Charles Voorhees as chief electrical engineer. They had no electricity at that mansion. Mrs. Ford had called Mr. Voorhees to come over to try and get the power plant running. He picked up Herb Hamilton, went over, and they finally got it out to a point where they were able to turn the juice on for the garage and powerhouse, the power plant, to try and dry out the circuits. And then Mr. Ford, this is before he had, the same evening he had the stroke, but earlier, came through the tunnel from the mansion and said, "We have electricity. I got to go tell Mama." And so Mr. Ford, he set the switch to light up the mansion, and it wasn't dried out enough, and everything went down again.
Oh, it's...
So Charles Voorhees was probably the last man to see Mr. Ford alive. Not the last person, but the last man.
Well, yeah, it's... Quite a character. I mean, you know, you just don't, you know, I can't think of anybody that in modern history that equals him in stature and, you know, breadth of character and stuff, you know.
I agree. And now from the younger generation, what do you say?
I mean, I would agree as well. The thing that I mentioned earlier that I just think is so interesting is learning about how highly regarded he was in his lifetime in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, you know, what Jack was saying with trying to name Dearborn Fordson. And just really the mystique of Henry Ford as this historical figure who you know, genius inventor, successful engineer, but also had that common man appeal, like Jack was saying, with working in the garden and having a farming background. And that's something I learned about when they did the World's Fair in Chicago, when they originally unveiled the Ford Rotunda. Part of the original exhibits that they had in the Rotunda was sort of a reconstructed Ford family barn where young Henry might have worked on his inventions. And I think that's, you know, from a more idealistic age of the American history. And we definitely have our innovators today. But, I mean, Henry Ford just had such a huge impact on, you know, Dearborn first, but the whole country and the whole world as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You know, I mean, just the whole concept of the Rouge Complex and, you know, I mean.
Well, and of course, Henry Ford had a hero, too.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's Thomas Edison.
I knew the two were good friends. I didn't know that he was, like, his personal hero.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why he moved Edison's entire Menlo Park complex to Greenfield Village.
I see.
And he named it as, originally it was named, and still is, I think they still use it in some ways, Edison Institute.
That's right. The on their taxes, the official name for the Henry Ford in Greenfield Village is still the Edison Institute.
Yeah, that's true.
And they have that, when they opened it, they had, and it was some anniversary of the light bulb.
It was.
And they had a big gala where they ceremonially flipped the switch.
Well, actually, they had a gala there. It was the grand opening of it. And I think it was the 50th anniversary of light. Edison's light bulb. And in the laboratory there, Thomas Edison sat down and recreated the original light bulb.
Wow.
And if you go there today, I don't think they've changed it. And even though they fixed up the building, I think the piece of flooring where Thomas Edison pushed his chair back, when he finished that, Henry Ford had the chair nailed to the floor. And I believe it's still there.
Wow.
They also have a, and this was a couple years ago when I visited, I saw this and I thought it was the coolest thing. But they had a painting of everybody who was in attendance at that opening gala. And
it's in the museum.
It's a who's who of American history. There's a couple former presidents. The one that I like to point out is Fielding Harris Yost, the famous University of Michigan football coach. Is there.
Okay. Yeah, he was good friends with Herbie Firestone, too, wasn't he?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's... And the thing that strikes me about... You know, they seem like a bunch of regular guys. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, you know, it may not be so. I mean, of course, I don't know any much about a lot of the people these days, but it was just interesting how they were just like regular people.
Yeah, they mm-hmm. were, and they had all their good points, and they had some bad points, but they were just like you and I and everybody else.
Well, sure.
They weren't, they were great folks. And well, I think, I can't remember all the names of the vagabonds now. It was Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, Burroughs, and I don't know if Firestone was part of that or not. I think he was. But they used to go camping, and it was, call themselves the vagabonds.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I find that. That's very fascinating, and you know, and yeah, you know, Dearborn's got a lot of characters. I mean, of course, you know, no talk about Dearborn is complete without talking a little bit about Orville Hubbard.
Well, he was definitely a politician. He was a politician of his day.
Yes, he was.
But he was also, if you look at his whole career, whatever he stood for or was doing would evolve to whatever he thought the people who were going to push the lever in the ballot box were in favor of. He had a good ability to read the public that was going to be voting for him. And a lot of the controversy he was in, really, Dearborn was no different than a lot of other communities, except Hubbard was more vocal about it than the other communities.
Well, he was, and of course, being mayor as long as he was famous just for that aspect of it, and, you know, I can't think of any mayors today that really have quite the colorful career he had, but he was a good man, and he did a lot of good
for the city, and he caused some problems for the city in the future, too.
Oh, he did.
But he did a lot of good. I mean, he created Camp Dearborn for us, our park system we have today, the DPW, our Department of Public Works, what it takes care of today. A lot of this is, you know, courtesy of Orville Hubbard. yeah. his administration. But again, he had his bad points also.
Well, of course, you know, but it's...
And I said it before, and I'll say it again, we all do.
Well, we all do, yes. And, you know, you can't go pointing fingers about it and stuff, you know. And I think that he's you know, a larger-than-life character. And I sincerely believe that he's done a lot of good for the city. I mean, when they opened the retirement community in Florida, I thought, you know, that was really an interesting concept, you know, because...
I haven't heard of anything like that anywhere, that, you know, the city was owning property or development on the other side of the country. What an interesting concept.
Well, the only ones I can think of that did that, you had, Detroit owned some properties out, like out in Wayne County. They used to have a Detroit House of Corrections that was, DeHoco, they called it. You know, I mean, but, you know, of course, all them properties have been sold off. I mean, but, you know, Dearborn, do they still have the retirement community down there?
Sold a few years back.
Oh, okay.
I was just down there this past weekend, and if it was still there, I could have driven there in about 15 minutes. I was thinking about it.
It was sold, I'm trying to remember now, just a few years back. I think under the current administration, but that's quite a long time, too. It got to the point, I think, where there weren't as many Dearborn retirees interested in buying into it as they had been in the past.
Well,
there's definitely people who would take the units to keep it as a Dearborn-only unit. I think there was a problem there. I think that was what was going on. I don't know all the details of it.
Well, you know, it functioned for a long time, and it was a good place. I remember hearing a lot of good things about it. So, you know, now that Dearborn's, you know, 90 years old, you know, I love the way it's developed. I mean, it was basically... an all-white community at one time, and now it's evolved into such a multicultural...
I think that's fantastic. Dearborn is a multicultural town today. The city, and I think most people embrace that idea.
Yes.
And we love it.
It is a beautiful thing. I mean, because, you know, I mean, that's, to me... You know, it's because that's what America was all about, and now I, you know, Dearborn to me is like an all-American city. You know, I mean, you got a lot of people that criticize it for its past, but it's outgrown that past.
Oh yes,
definitely. I think as a museum so closely related to the Dearborn community, it's sort of a big responsibility for us to make sense of everything that so many people have these great memories of Hubbard and all of the positive things he did for Dearborn, but we can also acknowledge that it was pretty outwardly exclusionary, and that now the city has changed so much, and really, I think, just a shiny example of diversity in America, and a really, really awesome collection of people of different backgrounds, and sort of an ongoing challenge here at the museum is how we can reflect that, because it's not too hard to talk about that Arsenal history, but the much more recent history with immigration and people coming from all these different backgrounds is something that we are very interested in bringing up in the museum, and something that we are definitely thinking about in the future is how do we address this, and how do we bring more people in?
Well, yeah, I think that it's a good thing.
Well, it's kind of interesting. You can go back to the same individual, Mr. Ford, again, that probably is responsible in the long run for that diversity we have today. Because with the building of the Rouge plant, with his $5 day, his 40-hour week, people flocked here from all over the world.
That's true.
That's true. Mr. Ford. And then later on, when we had another influx of people coming in because of problems in other areas of the world.
Sure.
They had relatives here already.
Yeah.
So where would they go? They come to the United States, where were they going to go? They're going to go where they have family.
Exactly.
And that's, I think, one of the things that is a wonderful thing that caused Dearborn to become so diversified as it is today.
You know, it's a great thing. Now, do you guys, you know, ever think of collaborating or, you know, like with the Arab American Museum?
We have a couple times.
Oh, you have? Oh, very interesting.
And I think, and hopefully we will be doing more in the future. And we've had a couple collaborations with them already.
Well, that's very interesting. That's
definitely
good.
Stop by the reception on Tuesday. They just inducted a new executive director, so got to stop by there, got to meet some of their museum staff, and they take a very national approach to Arab immigration. Their museum focus is definitely very national. So we, as a museum, I think, have sort of a vested interest in asking how can we also provide that local perspective. And we don't have that clean answer quite yet, but it's something that we're very interested in moving toward the future.
And we've been in contact with them for over the last 7 years. I mean, they came and asked us to join them in one grant they were getting, which we did. And we've had a couple events together, such as interviewing people and things like that. So more of that's going to be coming in the future. And I know with Paul here, and he's going to probably help work in developing that.
Definitely.
Well, that's very good, because I'd like to just shout out to Arab American Museum. I'd like to come over and interview you all. You know, it's because it's great, because, you know, as a nurse, I deal with people from all cultures, and you know, it's really, to me, it's what makes America great. You know, the constant inflow of new people and new cultures and stuff. I think that all Americans can learn from each other, you know,
and enjoy their tasty foods.
They do, yeah.
Yeah, that's one thing I say. It's given us a good group of restaurants where we can stay right in Durban and taste the cuisine from around the world.
Hey, you know, and where else but America can you get some hummus and then go down the street and get some haggis? You know, and you know, because it's, you know, all the great restaurants. So, well, briefly again, so talk about your upcoming events that you have.
Of course, the one coming up next week, Top of the Wagner, Durbin's 90th birthday party, 1920s theme. We still have some tickets available.
Oh, okay.
You can get them at thedhm.com.
Okay.
And if you decide to come, practice your Charleston.
Oh, is 1920s dress required or desired?
It's desired, but not required.
Oh, okay.
So that event is Over the Top at the Wagner, and that will be Friday, July 19th. So coming up right in about a week as we record this. And we are so, so excited to be having everybody over to the rooftop of the Wagner Hotel, beautifully renovated. It is going to be a fantastic night. Dinner, drinks, and entertainment.
Hey, yeah. What kind of entertainment are you having?
Oh, boy. So we will be having the Jerry Palmer Trio playing Music of the Era. And then we'll also have a couple performers doing some period dances.
Oh, really? Yeah, and then for the premiere purchasers of tickets, we will be having, again, period banjo music at the Commandant's Quarters.
Oh, very good.
Along with a champagne and hors d'oeuvre reception before going over to the Wagner for the main event.
It sounds like a very well-planned and thought-out event.
I think it is, and it should be a load of fun.
I'll have to find my zoot suit.
We're so excited for it, and we're so excited for the reception that we've got as well. We've really been selling quite a few tickets, and that really is just promising to be an awesome, awesome night. So as Jack mentioned, it's going to start off at 6 o'clock. We're going to have, for the benefactor-level tickets, a champagne reception at the Commandant's Quarters, which is just across the street from the old Nick Wagner Hotel. So we, at the Commandant's Quarters, we just finished a very large renovation project for the porches there. So we're very, very excited to show those off and enjoy the nice summer weather we've been having. At 7 o'clock, we're going to be heading over to the rooftop of the Wagner, and that will be fantastic. Ford Land, one of our sponsors, will be giving guided tours to show the renovations that they've done, and they're excited to show it off as well. It's going to be just a really great event. And if I could briefly thank our sponsors, we have Les Stanford, Ford Land, Dearborn Sausage Company, AFT, Local 1650, Dearborn Federal Savings Bank, Newman Smith Architecture, Park Place Caterers and Banquet Center, the Dearborn Community Fund, State Rep Abdullah Hamoud, and Mint 29. It's really been a community undertaking, from our sponsors to the committee planning the event to the people who are buying tickets. And as of today, we have less than 20 tickets remaining. The base level for that 7 o'clock start at the Wagner Hotel is $125 each. And if you would like to get the benefactor level so that you can come to the champagne reception an hour beforehand at the Commandant's Quarters, that is $250 each. And that money is going to be supporting us right here at the Dearborn Historical Museum, our exhibits, our catalog of historic objects, and making sure everything behind the scenes is cared for and accounted for, but also the community events and programs that we do. So we have a program called the Pioneer School Program for Dearborn second graders. So about 1,500 second graders pass through our doors every single year. And we get to teach them about Dearborn history and what it was like to live before electricity, which I know is shocking to some of those second graders.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, I was going to say, I want to add to that, too. It's a great event. It runs for about a little over 2 months. But if there's anybody out there who's interested, we can always use volunteers for some of our stations in that event. And it is fun. I do it myself every year. I'm teaching them about planting and the importance of a garden to a pioneer family. We also teach them how to do butter and what it's like to live in 1830. So we'd love to have additional people come in and help us with that and volunteer for it. So if anybody's interested, get a hold of us at the museum, 565-3000, and ask for Paul.
Yep.
And he'd be more than happy to sign you up.
Well, very good. And you also have a website?
The website is thedhm.com.
Volunteers are really the heartbeat of us at this organization, whether they're helping with our fundraisers, they're helping catalog behind the scenes, or like Jack was mentioning, they're working with kids and giving them a good historical experience. And we are always, always, always looking for more volunteers. So if anyone out there is interested, please drop us a line. We'd love to have you, and you can work on what it is that you're interested in. I know we have some volunteers who love historic clothing, so they come in a couple times a week, they're cataloging it. Some people like dishes and bowls, historic things, so they're working on that. We have people working on our computers, entering in information into a database. So just we're so, so grateful for people who graciously donate their time to us. And like I said, just volunteers are the heartbeat of the organization here at the Dearborn Historical Museum.
And it's a very awesome organization. I always remember coming to the museum, too, when I was a child and fascinated by the thing. And, of course, you have the... Is it still quarterly, the Dearborn Historian?
Yes, it is. The last issue out was commemorating the 100th anniversary of the building of the Ford Homes. And we'll probably have another issue out within the month, the next month.
Oh, very good. And I wish to thank Jack Tate, Paul Telp. Is it Telpos?
Telpos, yep.
For letting me interview them. I'm very honored. Think of it, volunteering, you know, I mean, that's part of what life's about. And to me, history is something that we need to know. History should be remembered.
Yeah, and like I say, people who are retired and would like to volunteer with us, it'd be fantastic, because they are probably the people who can offer more to these students than anyone else.
I you're absolutely correct, Jack.
Mm-hmm. Whenever I think of Dearborn, I think of the city seal where you have, I think it's Henry Ford and his quadricycle. Mm-hmm. And I just think, where better than Dearborn to embrace history? Because it's right there in the city seal, and it's kind of everything happening in the city today kind of relates to that history.
It really does. And once again, I thank Paul Talpos, Jack Tate, from the Dearborn Historical Museum for letting me interview them for this edition of the WHFR Journal. And thank you very much. You guys, you know, you run an awesome show here.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And yes, that was a very awesome interview that we had. I once again wish to thank Jack Tate, curator, and Paul Talpos, the assistant curator at the Dearborn Historical Museum. We have several events that they're having in honor of the 90th birthday celebration of Dearborn. At the Wagner, they're having a 90th birthday celebration next Friday, and it's over the top at Wagner. They're going to have entertainment. You can purchase tickets at their website. I believe they still have a few left, which is thedhm.com. Also coming up later here in July, on the 25th, 26th, and 27th, they're having a Museum Guild yard sale starting at 9 a.m. And who knows what they're going to have. I know they're going to have clothing of historical nature. They're going to have all kinds of things that be available for purchase, and the money goes for a great cause. Many other communities don't have
quite as extensive of a historical museum as we have in Dearborn. We consider ourselves very lucky. The Dearborn-Dearborn Heights area, first established, of course, with during French days when they had ribbon farms, originally settled by the Native Americans who kind of maybe were forced out by the moving in of European settlers. Had settlers like the Pardees, the Nowlands, many others. The Nowland, especially with the book, The Bark-Covered House, which is available from the guild. And they have the gift shop in the lobby of the museum there at 915 Brady. And you can also contact them at 313-565-3000. You have the McFadden-Roth House, the Commandant's Quarters, and you can actually have a lot of time spent there just wandering through the thing, looking at the old photographs, looking at good old Orville Hubbard statue in the back. They finally found a home for it. And, of course, you have the larger-than-life character, Henry Ford, who really his down-home mannerisms and his invention of the, well, he didn't invent the car, but his car was the one that caught on, and his mass production techniques that he developed really brought the Industrial Revolution home to the area and just to all of America. It made, helped make America the industrial powerhouse it is, and it still is. And coming up now, we're going to have our own Kitty Love with Highway 61. And I want to thank everybody once again for tuning in. And happy birthday to Dearborn. And it's going to be a great celebration. So there's all these events coming up. And, you know, they have coming up all kinds of stuff. I have one. And, hey, Kitty, how you doing?
Pretty good. Setting up my show here so we can get some brand new blues and highlight some individuals that may never get heard unless we play them on Henry Ford College Radio.
Oh, who do you got this week?
Oh, I got to look in my thing. I think we're going to start out with Kev Moe, but we're looking for the long time ever playing, what'd you call it, Highway 61 theme song, which was... is and was picked out by Joanne Korczynska.
Okay.
And she was from 1994 till 2016. She was indeed the blues music director, which I have that pleasure of doing now, making sure all the music is clean and nice. That's a beautiful thing. We always have to play nice songs. We cannot play anything bad, so I get to do that now. And the Highway 61 theme song is the Delta Bound song from In the Land of the Crossroads by Eddie Shaw on a Rooster Blues record label. And now it's time for Kitty Love.
Hey. Beautiful.
Of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, winner of the Spirit of College Radio Award.